Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias, what's up, man?
Hello.
How you doing?
Hanging in. It is indeed time to hoop it up for the last time in 2023. Interesting. We were actually at the end of the year. Time really flies when you're having fun and potting and watching basketball and hosting watch parties and talking to coaches and everything else that we've been blessed to do this year. It's been a little reflective this morning as I was getting some notes together. I was like, man, this has really been a fun year of content. Like, get to talk to you basically every day this year. Like, it's really been a joy. I just want to say I appreciate you before we dig into the pod.
Oh, thanks, man. Appreciate you too, big dog. Look at you getting your sentimental bag. When you said the last time kind of threw me off, I was like, wait a minute, did I miss an email?
I was like, yeah, check your text real quick. Just the last pod episode of 2023. Naturally, we'll be back next week. Ain't nothing happening there. Y'all good. Anyway, fun episode for you. Going to quickly go over some news items, and then we're going to dig into the mailbag for the last time in 2023. There will be more mailbag questions and episodes moving forward. Don't worry. We're not done. But let's quickly get into some news items. First, on the NBA side, Ja Morant and Joel Embiid being named Player of the Week. I want to give the quick hat tip to them. Ja, in his return, Memphis looks pretty darn good with them on the floor. Ja averaged 28, 6, and 9 last week, while Joel Embiid averaged 41, 12, and 6. And it probably could have been worse, or I guess better in this context. He's just been on an absolute tear in December. Obviously, hope he gets better soon. Did not play in the Christmas game against Miami as he's dealing with an ankle twist that he suffered against Toronto. So we're keeping tabs on that. But quick shout out to Ja Morant and Joel Embiid. Any quick thoughts on Ja since he's been back while we're here?
He's been really good. You are very quickly reminded the impact that he has on that Memphis Grizzlies team. Not just in pick and roll, but oh yeah, he can just get in the paint and teams have to help. And now that ball kicks out and oh, catch and shoot, or we can continue to keep the advantage. We can do the little things and play off of him. And so you can tell that team has a little bit more energy to them on both ends of the floor, a little bit more belief in what they're doing. You know, it's ironic considering most of our conversations with Memphis has been, hey, I would like to see y'all not just lean on Ja Morant. And then Ja Morant comes back, and you're quickly reminded, oh, I understand why y'all do that sometimes. so it's been fun. We're going to enjoy it, Nikias, until the MVP campaign starts up. Are you ready for that?
Can I go ahead and be annoyed / negative Nancy or whatever the case may be? Friends, Ja Morant has been incredible. He's been very good. The Grizzlies have just been winning and winning and winning since he's been back. Obviously, he's very valuable. We quite literally have a games played minimum this year for award stuff. Ja Morant quite literally cannot be in the MVP conversation this year. He was suspended for 25. You got to play at least 65 to get in. It isn't hate. He quite literally cannot be in this conversation. Please reframe the way we talk about him, how impactful he's been this year. He's not going to be in the award discussion. That's unfortunate. He's been very good.
Can I offer some more annoyance?
Sure.
Are you going to be more annoyed by the Ja Morant should be the MVP? Games played is silly.
The answer is going to be yes, I feel. Like, I do think there it's fair to bake in like a baseline of you got to be on the court to provide X amount of like total value. I'm in that camp. Like, even if you don't agree with 65 being the number, if you're like more 58 or 62, whatever the case may be, or if you're more of the they got to play 1500 minutes, I do think there is a baseline for award stuff. I'm fine with being in the minority on that, but I'm there. If you want to have that conversation, you can. I just want people to, as we get into like February and stuff, like let's call Ja awesome. Let's not call him MVP, considering he literally can't. That's all I'm saying.
Can I add another question?
Sure. What's up?
to annoy you, which doesn't really work because of the all-star voting formula involving the media. Which would annoy you more, being voted into the starting lineup, Ja Morant or Jaylen Brown?
Voting into the starting lineup? Because the added layer to this is that it'll just be like Ja and Luka, and it's just like, okay, why are either one of y'all in the backcourt in the West? And that's just going to be, oh, man. You know what? It might be. But also, Jaylen getting in over either of the Tyrese's would be kind of. Nah, it's probably Ja. He'll have the amplifying effect of Ja Luka backcourt when, dog, Shea right here. And also, Luka still getting guard votes. And, it's fine.
Hey, we're off to a riveting start of the pod. Hey, Dunkers, just bookmark this pod right here for when we do the All-Star Returns episode, and it's looking like Dame and Jaylen Brown on one side and Steph and Luka on the other, and Nekias will have that rant prepped and ready to go.
I sure will. I'm not going to like it, but thanks. Also, again, get well soon, Joel Embiid. He's been on an absolute tear this season. Can't wait to watch him play more basketball and anger more folks in the process, apparently. Anyway, Aaron Gordon, Denver Nuggets forward, out indefinitely after suffering face and hand lacerations due to a dog bite, which is very random. Not a fun way to spend your Christmas day. So apparently that's when that happened. Just hope he's able to heal soon, both physically and mentally, because I would imagine that's probably a lot to sort through.
Yeah, especially on that day and the way they just kind of let us know, hey, he's not going to be around for a little bit. Because of that. Yeah. And so hopefully he's okay inside and out and he heals. And what a wild time we live in, where we're in December and we've gotten player gets hit by car, player gets attacked by dog. Like, I just want everyone to be okay, man.
Yeah. Finger sliced up doing chores and finger slammed in car door. It's like, you shouldn't need the reminder that NBA players are also just human beings that go through random stuff. But like, these kind of serve as wild and random reminders that these are human beings that just go through random stuff. So I just hope Aaron Gordon is good. Some quick transaction news that I'm sure Steve is rolling his eye at. The Sixers signing Kenny Lofton to a two-way contract. They waived Javonte Smart in the process. We talked about Kenny a couple pods ago. It's like, hey, what are some fits for him? Would like to see him. Did either one of us bring up Philly?
No. Philly did not make the hashtag random shortlist.
Yeah, so I'm curious to see what that looks like. Mo Bamba must have gotten word of that might happen. That man balled out on Christmas. But either way, so Kenny Lofton going to be in Philly. Could see if he carves out any kind of time, especially while Joel Embiid is out right now. And as for the Dallas Mavericks, per Shams, they plan to sign guard Brandon Williams to a two-way deal. Brandon Williams averaged about 24-6 in G League play this season. And if you remember the random Portland breakout in the second half of that year, as they did not make the playoffs, averaged 14 points, nearly 5 assists in 16 starts the back half of the 2021-2022 season. I was one of the sickos that wrote about his pick and roll play. I think it was him and Drew Eubanks forming an interesting pick and roll partnership at the end of that year. So, shout out to Brandon Williams for getting the Mav spot. They look for more guard depth.
Oh, I wanted to go back to the Aaron Gordon thing. Just because for Denver, just on-court stuff, Justin Holiday has been the guy who's gotten in the starting lineup all four games that Gordon's been out this year. So did you have any thoughts about him sliding right in and plug and play, keeping your bench intact at all?
Not deep thoughts. Like, I should have asked, like, hey, how do you think they go there? But to your point, they have just pressed the Justin Holiday button to keep the rest of the bench intact. Makes sense. Justin Holiday has plenty of experience filling lanes in transition, also just playing off of bigs that serve as hubs. So I mentioned you get the shooting and the cutting. MPJ just slides down to the floor naturally. So his backline rotations become more important. Beyond that, nothing super major on that front. Like, it makes sense. I think we're going to see the same amount of staggering that we normally do. I think this puts more of a spotlight for me on Zeke Nnaji with the backup 5 minutes. So you don't have like the Aaron Gordon at center button. And so this could prove to be a pretty important mini stretch for Zeke Nnaji, who has been mostly okay this year. But like, I want to see better screening. I want to see better rebounding. I think he has a really unique skill set as someone that can knock down shots from the perimeter, someone that can switch. You want to see him showcase some of the other quote unquote big skills to really solidify himself as the backup five. So while Gordon is out, and again, hopefully he heals as soon as possible, this is an opportunity for Zeke Nagy to really firmly grab this. So I think that will conclude my Denver bench thoughts. Did you have anything more?
No, I just always thought, I think it's valuable to have someone like a Justin Holliday on your team that you can plug in when need be. And you know, hey, I could throw you in the starting lineup. You might not play for a couple weeks, but you're ready to go. We know we can get you, get out of you. It's a good base.
Okay. Got you. All right. Well, with that, let's get into the mailbag. Thank you, friends, for sending in your mailbag questions. Once again, you don't have to wait for a prompt or a call out. If you have basketball questions while you're at work, watching a game, doing some chores around the house, whatever the case may be, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Our first question going to come from longtime listener, Warren, who says, I'm sure you both have heard the Becky Cammon comments on shorter players as a number one option by now. While I thought it was a fair critique, unless you have a generational defense or Steph plus a defense, the chances of winning with a 6'3 or under player as your best player are slim. I wanted to hear your thoughts on what she said.
Ah, finally, we get to talk about this after we Eurostepped past it. Boy, the sauce, the recipes, everything got lost in that conversation very quickly. Like, I'm looking up, I'm scrolling around, I'm seeing steak sauce hoodies and blue and orange. I'm like, what is happening? What are we doing here? Why are we doing this? Like, it's a little ironic considering the Knicks have been in trade rumors for how many years now, including this year? Like, didn't I just see DeJounte Murray like 3 days ago? Like, I mean, come on. I did not take that as a complete indictment of Jalen Brunson as a basketball player. I took it as, hey, a very good basketball player and basketball coach and basketball mind is delivering her philosophy and thought process. I mean, once you named Allen Iverson and Steve Nash and went through the list, it's like, okay, this is a different conversation now. But there was no separation there. And I think people forget, or maybe don't know, Becky Hammon lived that life. She got a whole ton of buckets. She made it to the finals twice with the Liberty. Conference finals run with the Silver Stars. Finals run with the Silver Stars. How many rings is she getting, guys?
Well, no.
So that's where I was just like, I don't think it had to be as deep as it needed to be. And I feel like the conversation got lost in the sauce as people were trying to defend. And now it's just a thing now. Every time Jalen Brunson plays well, he's not a 1A. That's not the point. That's not the point. For me, when it comes to a player of that size, I do think there is an element of you walk down to the coach's meeting and you say, hey, I think we can trap the ball. I think we can put size and length on this person. I think we can show help on drives. I feel like there's something we can do to make this difficult for this player who scores very well. And if we can make it tough for you to get to your complete package of scoring, can you consistently impact the game otherwise? And like, especially in this league these days, if you are of a certain height, eventually you are going to get matchup hunted on the other end. You're going to be put in action. You're going to be put in pick and roll. You're going to be attacked. So you're going to have to handle that on that end. And then offensively, it's not that you're not talented. Your talent is going to warrant attention, and that attention is going to be to try and take you away. And if we can just make it tough for you, we've lessened your impact. I think that was it. That was the bit. I think it's less about, hey, a player X can't do that. No. If that player also has this guy, whoever it is, center, wing, whatever, now the whole package is maximized because you can't take all of your degrees and throw it right at me. In that way, we can mix and match a little bit to a degree. I think that was the point. But, you know, it'll get lost in the sauce. It's whatever. My other point was this. I might get booed. Outside of that Cavs series, how often do we see Jalen Brunson get trapped?
Well, because even in the Miami series, we are throwing length on you. And then we'll send help. It was more of that versus like pure, we're just trapping Jalen Brunson.
How often does he get doubled?
It doesn't feel like a lot, but I can quickly try to look that up while you are while you go.
No, but I mean, it's just for me, I always have an indication on what a team thinks of you and your talent level based on how they game plan for you defensively. And so Jalen Brunson has arrived to your point at, hey, we might need to trap him. Hey, on these ISOs, these one-on-ones, we need to show early help to try and take away the drive and hope we can contest the shot. But I don't think it's been a full out, hey, we're doing everything we can to take you away. There's still an element of, hey, you got to prove it. Prove it a little bit.
Gotcha.
You know, you go back to the Milwaukee game, but hey, we'll go late switch on the drop. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff.
Very quickly on second spectrum, Jalen Brunson being blitzed on shade under 5% of his pick and rolls, 4.85% among high volume guys. So 69 players that have run at least 300 pick and rolls. That is 20th. Luka number one at over 15% to kind of further emphasize just how stark that difference is. Gets it, but doesn't get it to the degree that a Luka does. Donovan Mitchell at 9.6%. Anthony Edwards around 9%. Devin Booker, after having low blitz numbers early in the year, he's up around 9%. Jason Tatum at 7%. Steph around 7%. Cade's at 7%. We know what kind of attention he's drawing because of the context in Detroit. So to your point, yeah, it's not as much as some of your higher tier or even just bigger players in general.
That's my point. Did you have anything to add to it?
I was annoyed by how quickly the conversation got distorted. So that was primary reason why I just kind of, I Euro-stepped it for the most part. And then I finally sent out a tweet like, I'm annoyed by the Brunson conversation because what are we even arguing at this point? Like, as you mentioned, as Becky laid out, like historically, it just kind of hasn't been the case. And like this morning, I was like, you know, actually, let me just look at finals MVPs, which is off real an incomplete picture because you can't be the best player for a series and not be the best player on that team. But just looking at finals MVPs under 6'6", not even going to go to like 6'1 or 6'2, wherever Jalen Brunson's listed at. Finals MVPs under 6'6". Steph Curry in 2022. Tony Parker in 2007, in a series in which Tim Duncan was still anchoring the defense and averaged 18 and 12 in that finals. So he didn't shoot that well from the field, but it's neither here nor there. Dwayne Wade in 06. Chauncey Billups in 2004. Isaiah Thomas in 1990. Joe Dumars in 1989. Dennis Johnson in 1979, and then Jerry West in a series that he lost. And so, like, that's it for under 6'6". If you get to, like, 6'3 or under, that's pretty much, what, the Pistons? And however you're feeling about Dennis Johnson and Jerry West, how they're listed, like, that's kind of it. And that's just, again, they were the best player, arguably the best player in that series. Historically, Becky's absolutely right. Now, the conversation that I wanted to have, and I eventually got into it on Twitter after I made the tweet, was like, I do think Jalen Brunson is insanely good. Like, he is one of the best three-level scorers in basketball. He's an improving slash solid playmaker. He can absolutely boogie on you. I think beyond him, and just conceptually speaking about, like, team building, I think the quote-unquote worse your best player is, the better the supporting cast has to be. And so if you don't have a no-doubt-about-it top-five guy in the league, that means you're going to need 3-4 top 40 players, top 50 players. You're going to need an elite defense. Like, the margin for error is so much smaller, unironically, I guess. But the margin for error is so much smaller if your best player isn't a surefire, no doubt about it, top five guy. Like, Jimmy Butler has led Miami to two finals, and we're still having the, there are still, like, rumblings of the, can he be the best player on the title team, on a title winner conversation. This is Jimmy Butler, who has both been to the finals twice and is, you know, for this conversation, we're talking about height and stuff, he's also just bigger than Jalen Brunson is. And we're having this conversation about Jimmy. So, like, I don't think it's unfair to say, hey, can Jalen Brunson do it? And I was playing 2K last night, talking to some of my pals. We were starting the thought exercise of, like, okay, how would you construct the roster to where Jalen Brunson is your best player and it's good enough to where they can be a legit finals contender or title favorite? And, like, off the top of my head, I was like, okay, like, I probably feel better about the offense and the balance if, like, instead of Julius Randle, you had Lauri Markkanen. Before even getting into, like, what would a trade take, how available Lauri is, et cetera, et cetera, just thinking conceptually, okay, we want to open the floor a little bit more. So even if teams decide they want to trap more, you just got more room to operate. If you're going to have RJ Barrett there and you want the fully maximized version of him, you want the paint more clear so his drives hit more. And you open up more to playmaking windows for him. And just kind of going through that. And it's just like, okay, you could probably get there conceptually, but then you have to have, okay, how do we actually acquire these guys? What assets can we use to actually make this happen? And then it's still going to be a matchup deal because to your earlier point, just by virtue of how tall or not Jalen Brunson is, he's going to be part of the mismatch hunting conversation. And you need your defense to be at a level to compensate for that. And I've talked about on this pod multiple times at this point about how impressed I've been with Jalen Brunson's effort defensively this year. I do feel like this is the best defensive season I've seen from Jalen Brunson. But at the end of the day, like, the height is the height. We talked about this dude, the Boston series, the Boston playoff runs last few years. Love Marcus Smart. When it came to those Heat matchups, Jimmy Butler was picking on him sometimes, just by virtue of I am taller than you. We saw it with Drew Holiday last year against Jimmy Butler. Drew's fantastic. Jimmy's like, I'm taller than you. Into the Eastern Conference Finals that Miami lost against Boston. Derek White, phenomenal defender. You are the guy that we're going to try to go at among the starters because you're the smallest guy here. And I think it's fair to say defensively, Jalen Brunson is not Marcus Smart or Derek White or Drew Holiday. And so it's just, I don't think that should be some personal affront to Jalen Brunson. I will say on the other side of the coin, I get the frustration from Knicks fans within this context to where it's the Knicks haven't done anything, laughing stock, et cetera, et cetera. They need to stop trying to make these home run swings. They need to build this team slowly and actually have a coherent vision. They do that. They have picks and tuck. You nailed the Jalen Brunson acquisition, and he's better than a lot of people thought he would be. And instead of highlighting, hey, the Knicks are doing good things process-wise, Jalen Brunson has been phenomenal. It immediately shifts to, well, Jalen Brunson ain't good enough to do this. And so many of the segments that I've seen are, hey, how did the Knicks get into this next tier? They kind of stuck right here. And I think sans the acknowledgement of where they came from to where they are and immediately skipping to this ain't enough, how do we get better? I can get how that would be frustrating. So I will give the bail there. I think that's fair frustration. I don't think you take that frustration and then go straight to like Becky Hammon's a hater or something like that. Or misconstruing what Becky Hammon said into Jalen Brunson isn't good. Because that was never the argument. And that's where a lot of my frustration came in with this whole conversation.
The frustration is fair. I don't think the Knicks get enough credit for what they are and what they've become. I mean, if you look at what Tibbs has done with this team offensively, considering his reputation and their reputation, I think it deserves a little bit more credit. Obviously, they nailed the Jalen Brunson signing, and he's made their team a whole lot better based on that playoff run and what they've done so far this season. So I get that part. I just don't like when you combine conversations.
Yeah.
I don't like the energy that's been displayed to misunderstand something, to take another conversation and fold it into this one, and now we're going to go off the top rope on this one. It's like, I get it, but also, that's just me.
No, that's, again, I think we're aligned on that front. And that's why, once I saw it going that way, I was like, I don't even want to talk about this. Because the heart of what Becky said was correct. And I don't, it can just be that. If you are frustrated about general Knicks coverage, like, that's fair. And you should have that conversation versus baking in. I think they, for me, it feels like they were more annoyed by the conversation being had at all versus what Becky actually said. I think that's honestly where it kind of got tilted. At least that'd be okay. I mean, you are welcome to push back. Like, bye.
No, I'm cool.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Any closing thoughts then?
Nah, I'm good.
All right, fair enough. Next one going to come from Stefan, who says, while Derek White has been extremely good this season and arguably Boston's second-best player since the playoff run last year, I feel the case for him as an all-star might be just a little bit of a reach. That isn't to say he hasn't been fantastic, but with how Eastern Conference guards like Jalen Brunson, Trae Young, Donovan Mitchell, and the Tyreses, Tyrese Maxey and Tyrese Halliburton, have been playing, is there really a case for him to make it over any one of those guys outside of just hashtag winning? Interested in hearing your thoughts on this.
I guess I'll go first. I think you have some thoughts here. I think Derek White has a case. I mean, if you look at a player with that height, averaging the same amount of stocks, steals plus blocks as Giannis and Herb Jones, pretty impressive. The shot making has gone up with good volume. He's making plays consistently for this Boston Celtics team, which is important. We talk about the strength of that starting lineup. He's a big part of that as far as being a threat. Context helps, but he's making the defense pay. Defense has been incredible. I think he's shown time and time again how important he is for the Celtics group. I think just the fact that people believe he has a case and you can make a case for him is good for the evolution of basketball and basketball discourse. Like, I think that's a positive to a degree. Even if he ends up getting in the Mike Conley, CJ McCollum, yes, but also territory, that's a good step for me at least. I think the problem for him is, again, it's a numbers game. A lot of folks, especially in that guard room out east, have a case. Haliburton, Donovan Mitchell, Damian Lillard, Tyrese Maxey, Jalen Brunson, Trae Young, Derek White. At a max, you can get six backcourt players in. So one of these people are not going to make it. And that's without, hey, frontcourt person. Mm-hmm. Here's Kristaps Porzingis. Here's Paolo. Like, here's Bam Adebayo, Jimmy Butler. There's someone who may all of a sudden pop up in the front court of the wild card that people don't expect. And also, There's always the element of who gets voted in. How does that impact it? And now Someone that maybe you had written down as a starter is now, oh, no. They have to take those two backcourt slots because they're really good. So now the numbers just dwindle. So I don't think It's a passionate, absolute Derek White has to be an all-star. I just think it's a salute to the season that he's had.
I think it's fair. Like, ultimately, before you can get into injury replacements, there are just 24 spots across both conferences to acknowledge all-stars. That does not mean there are only 24 players in the league having all-star caliber seasons or all-star caliber impact on their teams. And so, to your point, for Derek White to even be in this conversation, I think is a positive. It's a hat tip to what he's been able to do this year. To the heart of the question, because I had like a whole thing. I went through a rabbit hole.
Oh, but the question rabbit hole. Let's go.
We've done it. So the heart of the question is, how do you make the Derek White case without winning? And so naturally, not just Boston's best team in the conference and thus best team in conference for All-Star typically at least has two players strongly in the conversation, if not just two outright. So if you're eliminating that case, you can go with some of the stat thresholds. Derek White is one of five players, averaging at least 16 points and five assists with a steal and a block. The other four players are Joel Embiid, Giannis, Ja Morant, though he's only played four games, and Scotty Barnes. And I would say, you know, again, Ja's only played four to this point, but we know Ja's an all-star caliber, all-NBA caliber player. But the other three, Embiid and Giannis are locks for all-star starter, and I think to your front court conversation, I think Scotty Barnes should firmly be in the conversation for an all-star team this year. So Derek White's in that camp. And of those five players, he's easily the best shooter of the group. He's shooting over 42% from three on volume. If you care about the advanced stats or some of the on-off stuff in particular, he is seventh in EPM. And he's one of six players alongside Embiid again, Giannis again, Shea, Chet, and Anthony Davis with a +2 in offensive and defensive EPM. So if you want to go the two-way impact route, you have that number to point to. And in terms of the on-off stuff, this is something that I cited earlier in the year, but it's worth repeating. It's not that Boston's winning the minutes because Derek White is tethered to Jason Tatum. Like, obviously, his context helps accentuate everything that Derek White does, but it's not the reason Derek White does what he does. But to that point, in games that Jason Tatum and Derek White have both played in, thank you for that filter option, PVP stats, Boston has a +14.8 net rating with Derek White and Jason Tatum on the floor, which you're blowing teams out of the water at that point. When Derek White is on the floor without Jason Tatum, that is at +12.8, which, again, Boston blowing teams out of the water. With Jason Tatum on the floor without Derek White, a -2.2 net rating. So it's two-way impact for Derek White while also not just being the benefactor of I'm playing in elite lineups or I'm playing with the best player. It's not just that. They're blitzing teams with White on the floor, period, end of discussion. And I think beyond that, to make the Derek White case, I think you kind of have to reorient what you think about usage or how you think about utility in general. Because obviously, I don't think Derek White is the best player on this team. I think that's fair to say. And when you're comparing that to Jalen Brunson, who is the best player on his team, and Trae Young, who is the best player on his team, and Donovan Mitchell, who is the best player on this team, in terms of just pure on-ball usage, no, Derek White isn't going to be there. It's worth noting Derek White is third on Boston in touches. Like, he's averaging more touches per game than Jaylen Brown to this point. Jrue Holiday has a slight bump, but then you think about on-ball decision-making. Like, Derek White has ran the second most pick and rolls in Boston this year behind Jason Tatum, and there isn't a big gap between those two. But I also think once you factor in what Derek White is asked to do, the variety of his usage, not only running ball screens or just drive or attacking the basket, but what he's asked to do as a screener and also what he's asked to do as a spacer and how well he has shot the ball, like that variety, I think, can get you closer than what you would think traditionally in terms of how they're being used and how much they're being used and how important they are to amplifying what each team does. And that's before even getting into like the defense portion, in which if we're comparing them to like the two Tyreses, who I think they're just locks, I kind of want to have them out of the conversation. But if you factor them in, Derek White, just a much better defender than both. Much better defender than Jalen Brunson. Much better defender than Donovan Mitchell. Much better and just has more responsibility on that end, both on ball and what he's able to do on the back line. The block numbers show it, but just watch the rotations that he makes and the charges that he takes. Once you throw all of that in, again, I think there's still a general like usage responsibility gap. But I think you can kind of get to these players are asked to do more. Derek White is asked to do more things or different types of things. And depending on how you value those things, you can kind of get closer to the usage point. And then I was thinking about, I can't remember who sent the tweet, but it's an argument that's come out there when people kind of denigrate Derek White as an all-star because of the box score numbers. And it's like, the counter to that is, well, Mike Conley made an all-star team and he averaged 16-6 or whatever the case was. Why can't Derek White get in at 17-5? Which I don't think that's a great counter considering Mike Conley was an injury replacement, which would kind of prove the point. But even within that, I think about the Utah year that Mike Conley had, and he was very good running that offense, knocking down shots, defended well as well. But even that goes to the variety of usage point. In that entire season, on ball and off ball, Mike Conley set 201 screens. On and off the ball, regular season plus playoffs. Derek White's already at 184. We haven't hit New Year yet. So, like, is that plus the on-ball decision-making, plus the shooting, plus the defense? It's like, even there, you can make kind of more of a more holistic case for Derek White and what he brings to the table and how he amplifies what Boston does on both ends of the floor. So I think you can make the argument two-way impact plus variety of usage, aside from just the winning stuff, to get closer to the Derek White case.
You just unlocked a memory for me right there.
Okay.
Because I do recall very, very briefly that when the replacements were announced or we were trying to figure out, hey, they're not there, who gets it? There was a person on this podcast who said Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and not Mike Conley. And now this same person is making the Derek White case. And so that just intrigued me real quick. Just jawed something in my brain. I was like, all right, I see how the table has turned, apparently, now that it's not Mike Conley, but that's fine. It's okay.
It's not even that.
I'll move past it.
But here's the thing, though, Steve. Even with that, we just did the All-Star episode. Derek White was on my short list. He didn't make it for me.
No, you're good. It was just... it was a fun memory jogging exercise, but that's all. That's all.
I got you.
The other thing is, I'm going to briefly ask you a question that may annoy you.
Okay.
What has impacted Derek White's case more? The context for him with that lineup, the winning, or the fact that he's scoring more? He scored 20 more points 11 times last regular season. He's done it 6 times already. Is the fact that he is getting more buckets and that team is winning now putting a spotlight on Derek White in a way that it wouldn't have?
Probably so.
How do you feel about that?
Which leads to a whole other conversation, but probably so.
All of your stats were fantastic, by the way, but how do you feel about it boiling down to just that?
It shouldn't. Like, I would imagine that's why it's easier to make the case now. Like, if Derek White was having this exact same season and he was averaging 15 instead of nearly 17, the volume's probably lower. Even if he still had like the same impact and the same impact metrics and was still like top 10 in EPM, et cetera, et cetera. I think the scoring helps. Like, it's just an easier thing for people to point to.
Okay. And now I have another question.
Okay.
Why is Derek White's all-star case stronger than Kristaps Porzingis's?
For me, that would probably boil down to he's played 5 more games and over 200 more minutes. Because as we talked about in the Christmas episode, like, I am very much a fan of the amplifying effect that Kristaps has on both ends. and what his shooting does and what the post-ups do and what the rim protection does and how they're able to alter their matchups defensively because of what Kristaps can do. So I think if you're just looking for splitting hairs there, you could argue White has brought more cumulative value because he's been on the floor more. And then you look at it again, like I'm a fan of EPM. If we're going to find an advanced number, I don't think you should just look at one. And that's what it means, to be clear. But like even a metric like that, Derek White is so much higher than Kristaps is. Or just he ranks higher. Let me put it that way. I don't want to oversell it. But yeah.
No, I get it. But I mean, if there's a world where someone's going to be like, well, the Celtics are 17-4 when Porzingis actually plays. Plus lineup.
Which is insane.
Yeah. You know, just throwing it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't think that would be unfair at all.
Everybody just threw Jaylen Brown's all-star case over the top rope.
Which I don't really love. Like, it's so weird that, like, this feels like the best process season Jaylen Brown has ever had. This, for me, in the games that I've caught for Boston, this feels like the best defensive season Jaylen Brown has had. He is doing everything except scoring at the usual efficient manner that he does. Around 34% from three. He's not blitzing from mid-range like we've seen in years past. Like, yeah, so it's unfortunate. It didn't get into the line as much, just looking at the box score numbers right now. It does feel like his season just kind of going under the radar. Like, he might just be the biggest victim of, I don't care what Boston does in the regular season, will it matter in the playoffs? And just hyper-focusing on, is Jaylen Brown better at this? If yes, I feel good. If not, I don't care what else he's doing. But he's been really good this year. Like, it's... yeah, like he's been very good. Also on my short list for All-Star. Like, he should be in that conversation. I think it's just a really fun 2-4 discussion with Boston's guys. But yeah, that would be how I would make the Derek White case. Did you have closing thoughts on Derek White?
Mm-mm.
All right, let's move to JP, who says, hello, as a longtime Minnesota fan, I have appreciated Ricky Rubio's flair and passion for sharing the ball throughout his career. Players like him and Rajon Rondo and Nate McMillan always seem to know the shape made by the 10 players on the court, always seem to have hands in the passing lane, and were kind of bad at scoring. But what is it that made these natural playmakers so amazing at running an offense while being bad at being the offense? Are some people simply born with a sort of passing eye that somehow doesn't carry over to other aspects of basketball?
So, I mean, great question, JP. Is the bit here just shooting and hashtag lack thereof?
That might be the bit.
I mean, I don't know if it's purely a passing eye, although some folks have that and develop that quicker than others and maintain it. It may just be the fact that I can't just like automatically lean on this shot, or I can't drive it and try and finish every single time. So I have to have these drives. I have to have this craft. I have to have this skill. I have to be able to make plays. I have to be able to see the floor and to make up for some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're going to defend me in a certain way, I have to now re-engage you, force y'all to be able to, you know, think about what I'm doing. Now I make a play for someone else. I feel like self-awareness doesn't get as much talk because of the supreme confidence level that comes with playing basketball at a high level. But sometimes if you know, hey, this is not the best part of my game, let me focus on this other portion, you know, whether it's passing, defense, cutting, driving, to make up for it, and you can end up becoming more of a complete player in that way than if you are maybe a natural scorer. Because we see it in reverse, where people have the gift of scoring, and they have to learn the gift of reads and playmaking and what is open? What's the defense doing when I do this? So it kind of just goes back and forth. So, I mean, you could also develop that ability, but, you know, your scoring just comes in a different way.
Like, I don't know if there's a passing guy. Like, I do think it's important to kind of understand how you're being defended and what angles you can create. Because I think what limited them, you mentioned the shooting, obviously. But, like, in general, because they weren't natural scorers or, like, super athletes or tremendous shooters, like, these weren't players that were going to draw two to the ball and thus open up easier opportunities to open things up for other people. So you kind of had to have that vision or that craft and being able to understand, okay, I'm being defended this way. Where can I go to peel this weak side guy or attract this weak side guy or engage this big in a traditional pick and roll? to where I can really open something up, even if I'm not as much of a threat myself. Like, I do think there's a knowledge base, there's a level of feel that you have to be able to do that. And that's why the three players you named are like three of the higher IQ players that we've had in the league. Because they had that understanding of windows and how to create things and what defenses do when player A does this, player B has to do this, and thus player C may be open because of what player D did. And so, like, being able to process things and being able to manipulate things as quickly and as well as they were helped them open things up. I don't have the science behind that, naturally.
But, well, like, that would, I mean, be my it's read-off. Tough. It's tough because there's so much natural talent that goes with it. But again, I think it's just understanding, okay, I don't always get all of that attention. So I know if this player comes and help on me, or, you know, I force a rotation, I cut, and someone comes, I know where the ball needs to go. And so it's automatic. As opposed to sometimes if you're a scorer, I'm in the paint, or I cut in the paint, it's time to finish. No. I've worked hard to now get in this position to force y'all to do something. And now let me just dump it off, or let me spray it to the corner. That those type of beat plays. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I like this question, though. I like this question. It made me think. Like, how do you, like, what's the processing process of that? I guess for lack of a better way to frame it off the top of my head. But I appreciate the question from JP. Go ahead.
Well, no, I think that's one of the special things about Rondo, though. When he got in the paint, hey, I see all of y'all.
And also, here's this fake pass real quick. Let me get this layup off. The Rondo fake was so fun, dude. It's so freaking fun. But no, I appreciate that, JP. Next, we're going to come from Trey, who says, thanks for the quality episodes every week. Thank you. I enjoy watching the Sixers and how Nick Nurse has them committed to running and cutting hard in half court and transition. Their spacing, motion offense, and occasional flex and drag actions are super effective as Embiid continues to dominate and Maxey keeps flourishing. The playoffs are a different beast, though, and the game slows down a lot and teams will make defensive adjustments according to matchups. How effective do you think this free-flowing offense will be for the Sixers during the postseason against better defensive teams? Do you think there's a good chance of Embiid and Maxey relying too much on isolations and pick and rolls when the game slows down? So we'll start there because there's also a bonus question for Steve. But how do you feel about Philly's offense now? And what adjustments do you anticipate them having to make in the postseason?
I mean, I think it's a conversation we've had before and will continue to have. I think the answer is kind of a yes or a mix of yes. But I do think the positive for Philadelphia is that they are putting in the work with the ball movement, with the handoffs, with the drive and kick that should serve them well come playoff time. Because you also have the element of, we know our two best players are playing well. We know how to get them in their spots. We can develop that as the season goes on without having to lean on that to succeed. Because you can have Embiid one-on-one. You can play through Embiid with dribble handoffs, delay action. You can put Embiid at the elbow. You can throw it, obviously, to Embiid in the post. High pick and roll for Maxey with Embiid as a screener or without Embiid as a screener if he's with the bench lineup. The Embiid-Maxey two-man game that they can flow into at the end of possessions. Empty corner stuff that you can lean on and mix that in. I think it's more about the variety that they have right now. And the positive for the Sixers for me is that as good as that is, Embiid and Maxey, it's not the base. It's not all you have. And so you counter that with, and this is no shade or disrespect, okay, we have James Harden, Joel Embiid pick and roll. This is very hard for y'all to deal with. We also have Embiid at the elbow, Embiid in the post. What is around that? What else do people have? Now we have to generate things for Tyrese Maxey to open things up and hope that he can get going and make defense pay. Or we face a team that has the personnel to switch some of the Harden Embiid stuff or make it tougher. How do we counter that? Now it's a front, now it's a double. So now these issues kind of compound themselves in a way. So you kind of have to have that really good balance of, we know how to play outside of the play without sacrificing the development you need with your top stars or your top actions. Because, I mean, you're going to have to get reps. Eventually, I mean, the playoffs are about your top guys to a degree. There's a world where you might rather have that kind of offensive variety, that kind of offensive base established, and work on what's going to take you over the top in the playoffs. Rather than lean on, okay, these are our top two players. Let's run action through them and get wins. But now you get to the playoffs and a team takes that away and you don't have the other portion of it. You know, mm-hmm. for me, it's like the Milwaukee conversation. Like, let's just say they decided, hey, Giannis stay in pick and roll. Let's just smash that button. Let's smash it over and over again. You run into a team that has figured it out or is going to sell out and say, that's fine. We'll put two in the ball. We'll rotate to Giannis. We'll do whatever we have to do, play out of it. Do you have enough behind that? Mm-hmm. And so I think ultimately, once you get there, you have to be able to keep a defense moving. You have to be able to keep a defense guessing. And I think that's the goal for Philadelphia, is to establish that in the regular season while still making sure and Maxey and Embiid actions are growing in the right direction. And they have, you know. I think there's been an evolution there to where at first we saw some of the high pick and rolls that Maxey liked didn't necessarily serve Embiid as well, because his role, his short role, was to the three-point line. So basically it was just pop. Or you had, you know, okay, we set it lower, Maxey, turbo button, zoom, zoom. Oh, I've missed the pocket. And now you see them kind of developing the chemistry to, okay, pick and roll, you right there, I'm going to hit you real quick on the pocket pass. Or if we don't have anything, I'm going to hit you, I'm going to pass and cut. And we can just play out of that. They're starting to get that optionality together. So I think that's kind of the fun stuff. That's the fun stuff. Where it gets tricky in the playoffs, whether it's Philly or whatever team, you're going to have great players. Those players are going to be pressure points. And because you know the defense is going to react to them in some way, shape, or form, it's very hard to not just hit that button. And so what feels like stagnant offense has a purpose. It's just not being executed. Like there's going to be a game at some point, regular season, playoffs, the Boston Celtics are going to look at someone who is of a certain size in a close or tight game, or we need to close this out, and they're going to say, nope, we're hunting you. And it's not going to go well because they're going to play slow and take forever to do it. It happened last year against Atlanta. Like, it's just, it's going to happen. I'm trying to tell y'all right now. You have to understand the mindset behind what they're trying to accomplish versus what they actually accomplished, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think that's why you need those reps in the regular season. Understand, okay, this is a solid idea. How do we make it better?
Mm-hmm. I like it. And like, to the general point, like, it does feel like Philly has done a good job of balancing that, of emphasizing we do want to move more while also making sure we get enough reps with Tyrese and Joel figuring things out together. And even with just the Joel post-ups, we know he's going to get double. Let's make sure we get the spacing together. Let's make sure we're able to time our cuts behind some of the doubles that we know we're going to see. Let's get Joel used to making some of these reads, or continue that growth of him making those reads against double teams. Because many people point to, like, the assist numbers are at career high. And, like, one of the common refrains that I've seen is, like, well, yeah, you're getting a bunch more assists, just a bunch of handoffs. He's not making high-level reads. I'd say, nah, go look at the post-ups. Like, the passing there is better, too. He may not be getting all six of his assists via post-up, skip passes, or whatever the case may be. But, like, that progress is also there, and I think that's important. And so when you're able to blend all of that in together, when you have more movement, when you have Tyrese and Joel being able to play off each other, when you have Joel being able to make these kind of reads, it makes you feel better about what the offense is going to look like in the postseason.
Well, no, I hear the handoff thing, but I think it takes away, not only just from his post-ups, but you got to go look at some of these assists where Embiid is kind of going into his one-on-one game, sees you helping, and is letting that pass fly. That's a big difference. And that part helps Philadelphia's offense, too. So, you know, I don't like that.
I got you. And then just to quickly put a number on some of the half-court offense progress. Last year, the Sixers had a 114.7 offensive rating against top 10 defenses last year. That was about 2 points above league average, and that was ninth in the league. This year so far, a 115.3 offensive rating, but that is 3.5 points above league average against top 10 defenses. So you are seeing the progress there. If you want to put a number on it, they are doing better against stiffer defensive competition so far this year. Obviously, you have to see how much of that translates to the postseason. That's the point of this question. But I have felt better about the progress. I have felt better about the movement. Joel seems better. Tyrese Maxey surely looks better than he did last year. And so the early returns should lead you to believe this should be better than what we've seen, especially if both of those guys are healthy as we enter the postseason, which is going to end up being the big thing for Philly, I think, anyway. Also, bonus question for Steve. How often do NBA teams make offensive adjustments in the playoffs compared to defensive adjustments? My understanding is that most of the focus from the coaching staff is on the defensive side, right?
I mean, it's a constant deal. It goes back and forth. If there's two teams. So if one team is trying to make an adjustment defensively, we now have to adjust to what they've done offensively to take that off the board. So it just goes back and forth. If offensively you were attacking a certain matchup because the team was switching and then they stopped switching, well, now you adjust to attacking it a different way. Like for me, I go back to that Sixers-Raptors series. I don't know why it's burned in my brain when the Raptors were just switching everything. And then the Sixers were like, that's fun. Hey, let's have Fred VanVleet's man screen for James Harden first. Let's get that switch. And now we bring Joel Embiid in. And now we counter that. So it's basically just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I think about Boston, right? We see where they like to have their guard screen for Jason Tatum. Try and get a switch that way. If a team is doing a good job and saying, nope, we're just going to show him recover, we're not giving you that switch. Hey, Jason Tatum, why don't you be the screener? Let's reverse engineer it that way. They've seen this look enough. You screen. Oh, they gave us a switch. Great. We got what we wanted. So I think the offensive adjustments are a little bit more subtle. If a big is on a shooter, you know, we're going to see that tactic certainly during the playoffs. We've seen it sprinkled in during the regular season for some of these teams, some of these high-powered offenses, and is roaming to help. You move his man around. Maybe put him on the wing so that help is different. Maybe use him as a screener more. You know, different stuff like that. You know, even go to a regular season contest. Boston and the Clippers. Boston. Tatum is right there on Zubac. Al Horford's guard, Terrence Mann. First two plays of the game for the Clippers were just their regular stuff. Then they were like, hey, we should probably tap this button right here. Terrence Mann, you be a screener. Now, pick and roll chemistry wasn't the same. Didn't work out. But that kind of stuff. Like on Miami or Golden State, you stash Bam or Draymond in the weak side corner. Why? They can't shoot. Well, the point is, you're going to go help. We already know that. We're going to skip it to them, and now we're going to go right into different action. Look at Dallas OKC. You run a bunch of pick and roll for Luka, or you run a bunch of ISO for Shea, and teams are locked in on their help, or they're locked in on their doubles. Here's a post-up. Are y'all ready for that?
Oh.
You have your doubles and rotations. Do you have it all set up for that? Yeah, the middle pick and roll, you've done a great job. Or the one-on-one, boxes and elbows, you're doing fine. Post up, are you set up? Are you ready? The Golden State, they do it all the time. Yeah. Hey, good job defending. Here's a split to mess you up real quick. All right, reset. You know what I mean? So, I mean, you're just trying to stay ahead and flip what the defense wants to take away. I think the offensive adjustments can feel more subtle and can feel more in-gamey to a degree, whereas the defensive adjustments can feel series shifting or game shifting, or you can tell, okay, they did that differently and this impacted the offense that way. Whereas for the offense, my adjustment may just be to try and make you not do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Whereas defensively, you can tell they're going to stick with that. That's what they've done. You can write a whole article about it. If I know that you guys are switching this action and I hit it twice and you stop switching it, that can get lost in the sauce. Mm-hmm. But we've accomplished our goal.
That's good stuff. That's good stuff. It's always fun to tap into the Coach Steve bag. Next one is going to come from Calvin, who says, hi, Nikias and Steve. Hi. If the Sixers can't acquire a star this year, I think the best option for them is to go after another 3-and-D wing, but it has to be a guy who can also pass the ball because the Sixers are pretty light on playmaking. Unfortunately, I can't think of any guys in the league who fit this bill, let alone players who are available this trade deadline. This got me thinking. I can't remember very many non-star players in the last 10 years who can do all these skills well, shooting, defense, and passing. The closest guys I can think of are prime Joe Ingles and Harrison Barnes, although Barnes' passing leaves a bit to be desired. Can you guys think of any players in the league right now to fit this archetype, specifically among guys who don't need the ball in their hands a lot? What about the last 2 years? Bonus question, what about in the W? I would just say very quickly, like, the non-star portion of this program threw me for a loop.
Why?
Because once you remove, like, star caliber, all-star type guys, the list does shrink quite a bit. If you're thinking about the threshold of being a plus in all three of those categories, or even if you get more granular, like, okay, can you do this well within a playoff context versus a regular season context? And so as I started getting the list together, I was like, you shoot well from three, but do teams guard you like that? Do you really count for like the shooting category? Because like one of the names that I thought about and ultimately didn't put on the list was Grant Williams. I was like, okay, he shoots well. There is a level of switchability here. Then I had Steve's voice in the back of my head, like, hey man, guys really going at Grant Williams. And also, he's open on a lot of these threes for a reason. Teams are okay with living with Grant Williams taking these shots. So it's like, okay, he can technically do these things, and he's a solid ball mover. Does he count within the playoff context? Especially since this is a Philly, you know, this is within the Philly context, who they obviously have title aspirations with this group. And so I was like, okay, let's see if I can drum up like some non-star guys that could probably fit this threshold. And so like, this guy isn't going to be available for obvious reasons, but like, would Trey Murphy III count for you?
Yes, he's the first on my list.
Okay, okay, cool. But again, not going to be available because New Orleans loves that guy and they should. Dante DiVincenzo. Would that count
for yes. you? Yes, he counts. Okay. He counts. But here, before you continue to go on your list, I think it depends on the context. And it depends on what you're looking for. And how much of all three are you needing them to do? Because in theory, Philadelphia has plenty of options that could fit that box. And you could rotate if you find the hot hand. It just kind of depends. Which one do you value most? I think here's the thing, and this is what made it hard for me. Are we just counting the guys who alternate 2 out of 3? Are we counting the guys who we know can shoot the ball? We feel like they can do some of the driving and we can get enough of the defense. Does that count as enough? Or are you the guy who we know can defend, might mix in a couple threes, but we know you can drive a closeout? Like, do you just need 2 out of 3 from this category, or 2.5 out of 3, or the potential to get to 3, you know? And so in my mind, I struggled with, and I'm going to let you get back to your list, my bad. Are we saying this is pure, give this guy the ball and he can break this guy down one-on-one and start our drive and kick or operate and pick and roll? I think that list shortens very quickly if you're thinking that. Is this a guy who can operate in a dribble handoff? Can you knock down shots? Can you drive a closeout? I think that widens things out just because of how the game is played today with the amount of skip passes and who you're playing with and what they can open up. Mm-hmm. How much of the playmaking is really you starting it? And is your value more, I can make a defense pay by hitting some shots, but also by keeping our advantage? And that's where I think it widens out a little bit. And then defensively, can you just do enough? Like, is just being a do your job guy enough? Or are we looking for the lockdown, clamps, Hall of Fame, bronze, whatever? You know what I mean? Is that what we're looking for from the 3 and D? Like, and the funny part is some guys graduated that category. Before you get back to your list, like, where would Jeremy Grant be?
I feel like the passing would take him out of this portion. But obviously, he's a really good player.
But what if he's in a better context?
It's like he was in what, like in Golden State or Boston? Like with the passing pop more? I mean, we saw him in Denver.
Like, what if, like, who did I just have in my brain that just left me? Good Lord. Age stinks. I just had a player in my brain. like Tobias Harris. He's a Sixer. Where does he rank in this?
I also feel like a little bit below the passing threshold, but probably a little bit closer. Also, I need one of the dunkers to clip the age stinks part of what Steve just yelled out. I need that as a counter to when he tries to hit me with the age bit with players. Okay. I need that on record. Okay. But
Hey, dunkers, while you're clipping, go ahead and give me that Mike Conley slander. Actually, you know what? Hey, actually, you know what? Do me a favor. Give me the Gorgie Dieng love that Nikias had. Give me that and the Deadman love. We'll circle back. Go ahead, bud.
All right, I see. Anyway, Trey Murphy III was on my list. Dante DiVincenzo was on the list. Royce O'Neal was on the list. Who else do we have? Already a Sixer and like in a diminished state at this point. It's probably on the lower end. But like Nicholas Batum was a guy that I thought about that could do the pass, shoot, defend stuff. In OKC, Kenrich Williams, Aaron Wiggins with a question mark on that part for lower tier shoot, defend, make decisions on the move type beat. So those were like some of the early names I thought about. And then on the W side, it was like, okay, who am I considering like star class and who am I not? So like someone would count if we're not classifying her as like a pure star would be like Banaja Laney. But like I also feel like she's like kind of, she's in that tier loosely. Like Brittany Sykes would also feel like she feels like all-star adjacent or star adjacent. So like that doesn't seem fair. Below that, like Kayla McBride probably count. And I want to toss this name at you just to get your opinion on her passing. Where would you, would Rebecca Allen count for you?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, those were some of the early names I had on the W side. But who is on your list, good sir?
Well, what do you define by passing? Like, what is the passing threshold? I feel like you have a passing threshold that I'm not understanding.
Like, I think for me, like, it's, I guess it's bouncing off of what you said about, like, being able to, like, kickstart things or being able to make some reads. Like, I would like for it to be a level above attack, closeout, keep ball moving. Like, I'm not saying, like, you want Royce O'Neal to run 30 ball screens or, like, come off of 15 handoffs. But I feel like he can make a pass to the corner if he's tasked with just running one every now and then.
But what's more valuable? Like, wouldn't that make Gary Trent Jr. one of the top on this list, just based on his context? If he can get two on the ball and make a pass, isn't that a win?
It's a win. Yeah, maybe I'm just, you know, galaxy braining some of it. But
no, I'm just saying, like, if you are a person, what's more valuable? The person that can keep the chains moving once the advantage is created? Because how many of these guys that we name are going to get two on the ball?
Of this group, like, Trey would probably be the only one. And he'd probably have to have it going first.
So then what is your value playmaking-wise? That's just where my brain went. Max Strus, where does he land on this for you?
He was someone that I thought about.
You can probably... And now, here's the kicker. Here's the kicker, right? Okay. Movement. Mm-hmm. I counted movement as well. If I can run you off screens and make the defense react, is that not making a play? If I can get two on the ball that way or get you to shift and move, and now you got to close back out to me and something's open, and we've seen with Cleveland, especially in the stretch where everybody gone, Max Strus' value as far as being able to move and cut off screens and shift the defense, I had him up there. I got another one for you. You're not going to like this one. Bojan Bogdanović, where you at?
Well, friend.
The slander continues. We did it.
It's not even slander. It's just, hey, man. He is trying his best on defense. I just... Hey, man. Make my list. But if you have him on yours, that's fine.
No, I'm just throwing names out there. This is not the year to say Kyle Anderson because LOL the shooting. No disrespect. Would he be someone that counts?
If he could shoot, yes.
I had Royce O'Neal down. You already said him. Grayson Allen. Does he count?
I thought about it, but then it's like he just gets hunted because he's small. And I was just like, okay, how do I factor that part in? Because he'd be trying. And to, like, a lesser degree, like, teams went after Max Strus, too. Like, one, he held his own. Two, Miami, very aggressive as a help team. So, like, I guess if you have Strus, you can have Grayson Allen. But, like, as someone that didn't have either, I'm kind of like, eh. But I get where you're coming from.
Okay. Now here's my thing. What do you do with a player like Grayson Allen? Who willing to shoot, mm-hmm. might try to make too many plays. How do you balance that portion of the program? Because you mentioned, hey, I don't want to just be the ball movement. What do you do with the one who swings for the fences a little too much at times?
TV timeout with 7:26 to go in the fourth quarter. Come sit next to me, bud. Insert star.
Oh. Okay. Does DeAndre Hunter move you at all?
No.
Ow. All right.
All due respect.
Dylan Brooks.
I feel like the passing threshold gets me on Dylan Brooks.
Okay. Is Jalen Suggs just missing the shooting? Or does his cutting make up for it? Okay.
It can.
Is Herb Jones approaching this?
I appreciate the increased willingness as a shooter. I don't think he's quite there in this context.
Okay. Lou Dort. Very
quickly looking this up. Ooh, a career low from three right now. But anyway, Lou Dort.
42% from three. Will drive.
Yeah, he's shooting well.
Defense.
I guess this year it might count. They slip in some fun feeds from there every now and then.
Norman Powell.
That definitely feels like it does not meet the passing threshold. Also, the deep. Norman Powell on ball defense, maybe. Off ball defense, absolutely not.
Okay.
I'll get there with Norm.
That's fine. Okay. Aaron Nesmith, is he approaching this?
I had him on my list. And I took him off my list. I feel like in a context in which he does not have to, I guess, going back to season one dunker spot, if he didn't have to be like Indy's Royce O'Neal, please guard everyone, we beg, since he's been there. I could probably get to Nesmith. I think that, well.
Right. Even would you count Kentavious Caldwell-Pope?
I feel slightly under pass threshold, but like functionally, yes.
Lonnie Walker the fourth.
Not yet.
Dang. Does your opinion change if they stop shooting well? Like, where are you at with Bruce Brown right now?
I guess the counter question to that would be like, is Bruce Brown a wing?
What would he be?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. What would you call him?
He's a lot closer to the 3-and-D category than any other one. No disrespect. I know he's a guard. He don't want to be called not a guard. I ain't trying to do all that. But I'm just saying, if you had to place him in a box, probably.
No, I understand. That was an earnest question, to be clear. Like, I'm not trying to, like, do a bit. But just pure non-primary knockdown shots, make plays when necessary, defend. Like, I think Bruce would count.
Okay. Time to get to the make Nekias mad portion of the program.
Okay.
Najee Marshall.
Like the drives. Mostly cool with the defense. He's shooting well from three this year. You could probably push Najee in. If he's going to shoot like this. Okay. The problem that I have is I very quickly pulled up the basketball reference thing. Same amount of three-point attempts. And he was at 30% last year. He's at 40% this year. If that dips at all, that feels like a, we appreciate you, big dog. But for this conversation, I don't know about that.
Jaden McDaniels.
I can't get there, Jaden. Not yet. Pull up 2 and 3.
Killian Hayes.
Pull up 2 and D.
Killian Hayes.
No. All due respect to my guy, Killian. But no.
All right, mission accomplished. To my... I just feel like some guys are just going to alternate between two out of the three, especially with the context, the way things change. It's tough to get all three. To my W names, I had Benaj Laney. I had Dejanay Carrington on the way there. I had Carly Samuelson. I had Christy Wallace. I had Sammy Whitcomb with a question mark.
Okay. I think I'll probably say no on Sammy just because she feels very much guard to me versus wing. Carly Samuelson was also someone I considered. Christy, I didn't know what to do with her position-wise. But, like, as far as the skill set, I think she would definitely count. Dejanay, how do you feel about the playmaking from Dejanay? Because I feel like her drives are so high variance that I don't quite know what to do with.
When they hit, they hit. When they don't, they don't. But
it's, yeah, she's just like, ah. And I guess secondarily, how real do we think the shot is?
TBD. Okay. But special. I think it's gonna come.
It could. I think that changed the trajectory of what her career is going to be. Like, really good season last year. So don't want to, you know, I ain't trying to like denigrate her or anything. It's just, this is the first year that we've seen the shot go in and it still was a high volume. So that's where I'm just like, I want to see the sample grow before I commit to, oh, she is firmly 3 and D versus she defends.
Volume, schmolium. Give me my, give me my three attempts. Let me hit 1.5 of them. Get out of here. Well, I got to take 9 shots to tell you I'm a shooter.
Hey man, I am just a guy with a microphone. That's all. So next question gonna come from Alexander.
No, come on.
Who said,
hey,
what? I'm just saying.
Hold on. You are Nick enough.
Gosh darn it. No way you proud of that. Anyway, Alexander says, hi guys, I love your podcast. I hope you stay together forever and you keep producing quality stuff. Appreciate you, big dog. I have a question about the Phoenix Suns. How do you feel about Booker being the primary ball handler on the team? I have watched most of their games this season, and I must say I don't really trust him being the primary decision maker on the team. It's true his playmaking has improved drastically in the past few seasons, but he still lacks the game knowledge of when to attack himself and when to involve others. I do believe the team would function better if Booker moves to shooting guard, his natural position, and KD takes on more of the primary ball handling responsibilities. KD had extraordinary pick and roll numbers when he was playing for the Brooklyn Nets, and I do believe Kyrie and Booker provide a similar skill set and are much better suited being a secondary ball handler. What are your thoughts? Can the Phoenix Suns win the NBA championship with Booker playing the point guard role? I must say, very quickly, I'll let you answer first, but I'll just say it's great timing to get this question in on this episode right after KD dropped 16 assists. Couldn't have picked a better time for that question to hit air, but I'll defer to you very quickly. What you got?
Well, I was going to say, does Devin Booker lack the game knowledge of when to attack himself and when to involve others? Or is he just a very good scorer who can also make very good plays? Like, I feel like that's a balance people got to understand. I don't think it's guys not knowing. You got to remember, scorers are aggressive. They're going to hunt shots sometimes. You know what I mean? A bad shot for Devin Booker is just, you know, something that he can also make. So you got to live with some of those. For me, I personally think the primary playmaker, the point Booker, point Beal thing gets overblown to a degree. Because at the end of the day, it's just about pressure points. And the thing with Booker and Durant is they are both going to get their touches. They both are going to get them in different ways. And the defense is either going to have to react or give something up. And then by giving something up, they eventually will react. I think that's the whole bit with it. I don't weigh it as much. Like, I don't think Devin Booker is going to hold them back. Because if Devin Booker is able to get two on the ball and pick and roll, what does it open up? Can they make it? Can they make teams pay? If Devin Booker is getting downhill on handoffs and now forcing two on the ball or forcing help, or he's scoring a lot, does that open things up? I think that's the thing for me. The most important thing for Phoenix is use your versatility of both of these players to your advantage. Be able to alternate with pin downs and handoffs and transition attacks, post-ups, pick and roll. That's where the sauce is for them. So where now, okay, we're rotating, we're moving. We don't know exactly what it's going to be. It might be Devin Booker in pick and roll. Might be a design set for KD to come off a handoff. Oh, no, he back cut. Now KD's in a post-up. Now Devin Booker and KD doing two-man game. It's waves. It's waves. Yes. So, I mean, even if you move Devin Booker to the two, is that changing how much the ball is going to be in his hands? Is that changing what sets are being run for Devin Booker? Is that changing the overall complex of what they want to get to? Like, I think it's got to be a wave. You know, I watched the Suns-Rockets game. Hey, Eric Gordon, heard you, bud. Why don't you bring the ball up here a couple times in the first quarter? And he gets a quick pick and roll. He drives and finishes. Does that mean Eric Gordon's about to get more pick and roll? Not maybe. Does that change how teams are going to guard Eric Gordon?
I was just going to say quickly, you got to indulge Eric Gordon for the revenge game. That's all.
I don't think that makes Eric Gordon the one, you know? If you get KD with a matchup the defense doesn't like and teams feel like they have to double when he's posting up or he's at the elbow, they have to send help, you keep running it, does that make him the primary playmaker? When Bradley Beal comes back and he's getting dribble handoffs and Kevin Durant and Devin Booker on the right side of the floor, the strong side staring at him, does that make Beal the primary? No, I just think it's got to be a flow. You need to mix in Nurk with his dribble handoffs, and that's what it's got to be. You know, can we get, we have three guys who can get two on the ball in different ways. These three guys can also get buckets and punish if you're in drop. We can eventually get you a spot where you have to react. We make you pay. That, to me, is the overall Phoenix Suns or at least what it could be or should be, wave mm-hmm. for them. So I don't think it's going to be, oh, late game, Devin Booker has to make the play. You know, you'll probably see them in action together. Where's Devin Booker, KD, throw it to KD. Oh, we got the matchup. We play out of that. Or Booker has the matchup. However it goes, they're going to find the pressure point. They're going to tap it, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Most important thing for me, forget point Booker. They need to find a way to make this defense function to where this will make sense once Bradley Beal comes back. That's it. All this noise about the Phoenix Suns being terrible. They get their defense up to a C+, and Bradley Beal gets healthy. It's a different team. Just want to say that because everybody's being very loud, and it happens every time when a Western Conference team loses a 1-2, or dare I say 3 games, and now they're the worst team on earth. And it's like, hey, they lost to another good team.
I feel like you've had that one on your soul for a minute now.
No, I just see it. I see it every week, Nekias. And it just bothers me. Like, why? Why do we keep doing this? Hey, that OKC team? Think about this, Nekias. Lakers make the lineup change. People saying this is the worst move I've ever seen. Doesn't make any sense, whatever. Guess what the Lakers did? They go out and beat Oklahoma City. You know what Oklahoma City did later? They beat the best team in the conference, Minnesota. This is how it's going to be, folks. This conference is nasty. This conference is nasty. Dog, we just sat on Christmas and watched Luka put on the performance of a lifetime and get Phoenix out of here. And now everyone's like, oh no, Phoenix is buns. And then Phoenix beats Houston and Dallas goes to lose to Cleveland. The NBA is competitive.
Wow, that man pulled a Joe Johnson. What you mean 29 in the first half? Did you only? Anyway, so yeah, that's just the nature of NBA basketball right now.
Sorry, Alexander, that wasn't directed at you. It's a very quality question. You became the vessel for takes that I have seen. I understand your concern with Devin Booker and potentially, you know, him just being the only one making plays. My idea was to let you know it won't just be him. I'll put it that way. Sorry, big dog.
I love that. Like, I think it's less for me, like, Booker at point guard, because I think the reads have been really fun with Devin Booker this year. And I think even the game sense to when to attack versus when to get others going, like, I think that's gotten better as well. So, like, I don't really have concerns there. For me, it's like, how can we, and it kind of bleeds into the question I asked you at the end of the last pod about seeing it. Phoenix's shot distribution and the star shot distribution. How can we get Devin Booker more off ball by virtue of just getting the 3-point attempts up and trying to spread the defense out that way? And to your defense point, I think an underrated thing about Phoenix the last few years, and Devin Booker in particular, is that his defense has gotten better as the contest has gotten better. And the defense has not felt the same for Devin Booker this year. And I don't really think that's his fault. I feel like part of that is I have to run the offense because we don't have Beal and we don't have another guard that we trust to run offense and or doesn't get a bunch of unders and thus doesn't really create advantages for us. And so, like, I think some of that hurts. In addition to, like, they have a different center, which means their schemes have to alter a little bit and they have to do different things. And so I would like to see Devin Booker do less on the ball by just to help the other stuff, not because he can't do the on-ball stuff. And even to the offense point, if I can scroll in my notes very quickly, 38.1% of Devin Booker's twos are assisted this year. That is his lowest mark since the 2018-19 season. Half of his threes have been assisted, which is a career low. And he's also at a career low in terms of three-point rate, which is simply the percentage of total shots coming from three. If you can find someone trustworthy to handle more of the reps, even if you distribute some of that more to Kevin Durant and let him run more things and hope he can draw too. Like, getting Devin Booker easier looks, I think, will just take burden off of him offensively and defensively, like less energy exerted. So, like, within that context, like, yeah, I'd like to see him more off ball. But I haven't seen anything on ball to where it's like he can't handle this. He is bad at reading the game moment. And that's with me saying, like, it feels like the shot distribution has been mid-range heavier for Devin Booker than usual, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think, to Steve's earlier point, like, his scoring opens up the playmaking versus the reverse. And I don't think that's a bad thing because the playmaking has gotten so good. But it's still, I draw two because I get buckets if you don't send help. And so even with him playing point guard, that doesn't necessarily change who he is. So I think that's ultimately where I land. Any closing thoughts on KD, Booker, et cetera?
I would probably vote that I would want Devin Booker and KD's pull-ups or their mid-range percentage to go up. Like, that would be concerning, more concerning to me than the playmaking portion.
Mm. Okay, okay. Let's get this one from Craig, a two-pack from Craig, who says, "Hi, Nikias and Steve. I love the pod and always learn a lot from listening. I especially like how you devote time to the W as well as the NBA. I have two defense-related questions for you. Number one, who is on your tries hard on defense first team, i.e. players that may not have the tools to make your shortlist for the all-defensive team, but whose effort on that end you really appreciate? Steve, who would be on your try-hard defense team?"
Well, I kind of just made it an appreciation deal. Like, hey, you be trying. I don't know where to put you. Lou Dort, Dylan Brooks, Asar Thompson, De'Aaron Fox, Bojan Bogdanovic, Matisse Thybulle, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Tari Eason, Keegan Murray, Russell Westbrook, Josh Hart, Bilal Coulibaly, Peyton Watson.
Good. I love that this is basically your version of, like, the long list that I had on the award episode. For me, as I tend to do, I thought a lot about this. And I was like, you know what? I already gave, like, my all-defensive teams plus the short list plus the long list. Let me mention players that were not on the short or long list and give some quick shout-outs to guys whose efforts I appreciate, even if I don't think they've been all-defense level. I will recycle the Jalen Brunson love that I've given for his effort defensively this year. I think still with the size and some of the help limitation because of the lack of length, like, I think he still lands at, like, neutral at best defensively. But, like, he's taken a massive step up on the defensive end. I appreciate his effort. Malik Beasley, who is very much overtasked with who he's being asked to guard. He should not be a defensive stopper on a team with title aspirations, to be frank about it. But he is trying his best to navigate screens and reattach and not get into foul trouble. He's working very hard, so I do want to salute him for what he's been asked to do. Isaiah Joe has taken meaningful strides defensively for OKC. And because of that, he's been able to play more. You've seen him sprinkled into some closing lineups. You can really get the full breadth of what his shooting and screening does because he's able to hold up better defensively. So I want to give him the shout. Also want to give love to Keegan Murray, who Mike Brown has basically said, "Nah, you're defending tough matchups this year. Let's see what you can do. You're also going to take all these shots." And so he has really taken the challenge defensively. I think he deserves some love. And Daniel Gafford was another guy that I want to shout out. As that guy is working and he is blocking a lot of shots, he is challenging a lot of shots. He, again, not someone that's going to be near my all defensive team because there are just, he does too much quite a bit. But for a Wizards team that is not very good, he has done, I think he's just had an underrated season, period. I want to give Daniel Gafford some love, but he is working on defense as well. That would probably be my try hard first team at the very least. The second part from Craig: "I love watching Craig Porter Jr. block shots. And it made me wonder, who do you think are the best shot blockers 6'2 and under during your time following the NBA?" The 6'2 part threw me for a freaking loop, dog.
Well, no, all the people, all the names that I ended up having, I was like, oh, yeah, Derek White, 6'4. Oh, no, D Wade, 6'4. Yeah. Oh, no, Russell Westbrook, 6'4. So I was like, well, John Wall, well, is it just Kyle Lowry and Patrick Beverley? Is that the bit?
That's probably it. And then even that gets me to, like, the one of the stat pet peeves, where it's like it's a strip down and not like a pure block, but it gets counted as a block because guy's going up for a shot. It's like, so yeah, but, like, also no. Like, this is more, I appreciate your hands more so than, like, you are blocking shots. As far as, like, where the heck he come from blocks within this group, like, Cole Anthony was the name that popped for me. Because he's had some fun ones over the last couple of years. It's kind of similar in the, like, strip vein. But, like, Eric Bledsoe will also surprise you when he was, like, doing the thing with Milwaukee. Those are really the two, because I had the same height issue. I was like, okay, cool. Dwayne Wade, no. Derek White, no. John Wall, no. Even some, like, the chase downs from D'Anthony Melton, like, he's still, I think he's listed as 6'3 or 6'4. It's like, no. The 6'2 or shorter kills me. Like, but to the point of the question, to the heart of the question, like, that's what's making the Craig Porter Jr. season so fun. Because he is the size and he's legitimately getting on and off ball blocks this year. So, like, he's had a fun year for Cleveland. It kind of stinks that it's under these circumstances that he's had to play. But I'm glad that he's gotten his playing time. because he has been very fun, very good. Final question going to come from Matt, who says, hello. I wanted to end the year out on a fun question since there has been a lot of nonsense in the league lately. Nikias, since you consistently bring up your bingo card for 2023, what exactly is on your bingo card? Steve, please chime in on what was on yours as well. Thank you for all of your work. I hope you and yours have a wonderful holiday season. Well, thanks, Matt. And as I do frequently say during like games, watch parties, et cetera, like, huh, didn't have this on my bingo card, or saying that during the pod. I love this question. Very creative, very fun. In typical Nikias fashion, I do, in fact, have like an actual bingo card listing. So if we are excluding the free space, I do have 24 items that I would like to list out heading into the year of things that I expected to happen or expect to happen. And so some of these were predictions, like when we did the season preview episode, I had Jason Tatum as the MVP, as my preseason MVP pick. That's not looking great right now, though Jason Tatum's having a really good year. I had Evan Mobley as my defensive player of the year pick. That seems to be cooked with the amount of time that he's going to miss, in addition to what Rudy Gobert, Anthony Davis, Bam Adebayo, et cetera, what those guys are doing defensively. Mobley's just going to miss out in terms of games requirements, so that seems cool. Wimby Rookie of the Year. Still very much has a chance, but I do have Chet as my number one right now. A Scotty Barnes Leap. He was my most improved player pick heading into the year. Seems reasonable. I don't think he wins it, but he's having one heck of a year. Kickball Rant. I've already done that. A Screening Rant. I've already done that. Player X Revenge Game. I've done that on this podcast. Mark Williams leads average or better defense in his minutes, which was the case last year when he became a starter. This year, a 118.6 defensive rating with Mark Williams on the floor, that would rank 23rd, though they have a 125.8 defensive rating with him off the floor, which is easily the worst defense in the league. So having big impact, but the defense hasn't been good with him on the floor. That kind of stinks. A LaVine or DeRozan trade, neither has happened yet, but it does not seem like Zach LaVine is long for Chicago, so I may be able to mark that down later in the year. A Trey Murphy III breakout. He was going to be my most approved pick, and I said so on the pod over the summer before the injury was announced. And so, like, that seems cool in terms of games played as well, but he is playing well. A Damian Lillard game winner. A Chris Paul 15 assists, zero turnover game. He does have a 13 assists, zero turnover game, a 12 assists, zero turnover game, and an 11 assists, zero turnover game. Doesn't have 15 yet, so that space is empty. Dylan Brooks antics, if we are counting the pregame stare downs, I think that would do it. Tyrese Halliburton jump passes, that seems like a very firm yes. A Paul George 40 ball, season high of 36 right now, so we're waiting. James Harden trade, that's happened. Bam teaches the lesson, shout out Cooper Moorhead. If you want to quickly go back to the ISO stop and block against Damian Lillard in in-season tournament play, that was a fun one among the many others that Bam has had this year. A Jaden McDaniels 3-block game, and he had 3 against Miami literally last week, so if we can mark that space in. Kenrich Williams leads a game in plus minus. It's going to let y'all look that one up. Have some fun with that one. A Franz Leap, that hasn't quite happened yet in Orlando, but he is playing pretty well. Kata Bates breakout in Phoenix, that hasn't happened. I was very high on that offseason signing as like a sleeper thing, and he's had some flashes earlier in the year, but that hasn't really come to fruition yet. Bobo highlights, I don't want to talk about it. A Devin Vassell Leap, not quite Leap, but I'm glad more people have recognized that he's good at basketball. And a Jordan Poole 40 ball. Season high is 30 right now, and he's done that 3 times. So we're still trying to fill out the bingo board, the bingo card, rather. But that is what I have on my bingo card of 2023. Steve, how did I do?
Oh, 15 out of 10, would recommend. I'm not topping that.
I'm not topping that. It's crazy. What's on your bingo card, friend?
I just said I'm not topping that. You got free throws? Yeah, you are you going to do a whole full bingo card and be like, what's on your? No, congrats. Well done.
What you mean? The question says, Steve, please chime in on what was on yours as well. Hey.
I chimed in.
That's fine. What Steve mean? Has his the positivity space has been filled on Steve's bingo card. I'll answer for him. I have a singular free throw question for you. I wanted to drop it at the end of the pod since we'll see if people fast forward, etc. How quickly did the meme hit the Denver Nuggets group chat?
That's probably a couple days away.
Okay.
Probably a couple days away. Okay. Once everything's confirmed and he's in better spirits, I think Tiger Woods in an X-ray may make an appearance.
That's kind of tough. You have free throws, good sir.
Yeah. Better all-star case, Paolo or Scotty Barnes?
P.U. Gosh darn it, man.
Should have put that on your bingo card, pal.
I see. We like a good callback. Honestly, I probably feel a little bit better about Scotty's years than Paolo's, but like Orlando's winning, Toronto isn't. So I guess it's Paolo by default.
Okay. Better DeJounte Murray fit, Lakers or Knicks?
Lord. Knicks and seven? I don't really love either one of those.
Okay. Ja Dance Discourse or Zion Tattoo Discourse?
Give me the Zion Tat Discourse, because at least that's just funny. We're just being stupid over the Ja thing. We don't have to do all this. Also, Zion, why is that off-center, though? Like, I don't get... Anyway, not my business, not my body.
Stronger, they need to make a trade. Lakers, Sixers, or Thunder?
Probably Lakers. Lakers, Thunder, Sixers would probably be how I'd rank them.
Okay. Andre Drummond had a 20-point, 20-rebound game. DeAndre Jordan had a 20-point, 10-rebound game. Do you still think Gorgui Dieng is better?
Well, saying that Gorgui is out of the league. No, I do not believe so. No.
All right, perfect. What's funnier? Someone asking, does Kevin Durant make his teammates better, or Kevin Durant responding by tying his career high in assists with 16?
It's the latter, because you know he saw that tweet. This isn't that dissimilar to like, this is like the Cat fan account that tweeted out, I'm not tweeting again until Cat drops 40 or whatever it was. And then Cat did it, and then quote tweeted, like, I saw this tweet, not gonna lie. Like, well, athletes, they're just like us.
Which defensive duo do you trust more in the playoffs? Duncan Robinson and Tyler Hero, or Damian Lillard and Chris Middleton?
Oh, Lord. It might be the Miami duo. That's
more fed up on Christmas. Steve Kerr or Devin Booker?
Nah, it had to be Devin Booker. It was a hard-fought season game series.
Oh, okay. Finally, last one for you. All right.
Okay.
What was the worst mispronunciation? God, that's on brand. Worst mispronunciation.
Tremendous.
Of all the times to bring it how to speak, that's perfect. Worst mispronunciation of your name this holiday season.
Oh, this holiday season? This holiday season, it probably just Nikias, as I was getting into Uber, because like Uber just doesn't say my name right. And so I go to door, window rolls down. Are you Nikias? Like, Nikias, yes. And it's very quick, you know, very quick correction. Hop in car, we're good. So that's probably the worst one I've gotten this holiday season. The real bit is that the worst pronunciation is just Jackson, since I'm just being impersonated on Twitter. We're going to lean into that bit.
I don't like that.
But
I don't like that. I don't.
Like that.
Get Jackson out of there. Hopefully Jackson can show off his Sparks gear.
Thank you for... Can't believe you slipped that in there. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Also, first episode of the week is on JJ Redick's YouTube channel. So if you're more of a YouTube watcher, check us out every Tuesday on JJ Redick's YouTube channel. So thus, subscribe to the channel if you like our content. Also, a lot of great content on the channel overall. JJ kills it. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join us in the Dunker Spot community. We're having fun. But if you really want to have some fun, Join us for the Dunker Spot online watch parties. Friends, we are going live basically every night, bouncing around the NBA slate, live analysis, live breakdowns, breaking down stuff, going through clips during timeout breaks, end of game stuff. Steve did an excellent job breaking down why the Mavericks' last second possession against Cleveland last night didn't work. We have plenty of fun like that. Also, just a general place to let your hair down, have real life conversations if you want to. We invite people on stage sometimes to chop it up with us, ask us basketball questions, ask for life advice, rant about what's going on in life. It's a really fun, inclusive, wholesome with an asterisk, but we have a very inclusive and respectful space. So if you want to rock with us, the link to the room is hyperlinked in your podcast description. Just click on that. Enter your information. It is free. No shenanigans. And if it's not hyperlinked, just copy and paste the link into your browser. Once again, it is free. No shenanigans. If you got a lead pass subscription and or cable subscription, you should be able to rock with us. And with that, happy holiday season. A happy new year to y'all. And we will catch y'all next week.
Be safe. Bye.